Excellent. On to the fun part of the day. The first issue is an issue dealing with gross versus net revenue reporting. Seems a little bit like deja vu to me. I remember dealing with this issue around this same table in the late 90s, but transactions have evolved since then, and obviously with a new revenue recognition standard as well. I think there are, as the paper outlines, some questions in practice that certainly bear consideration by this group and input that we can benefit from as a collective group of boards. Mary Mazzilla is going to walk us through that issue, and I'll turn it over to you, Mary.
Thanks, Jim. Some stakeholders have informed the staff that there may be multiple interpretations of the application of the guidance in the new revenue standard about determining and accounting for whether an entity is a principal or an agent to contracts for certain intangible goods and services. Under the new revenue standard.
Sorry, Jim, could you just move the microphone a little bit closer because you come and go? Yeah, that's better. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Under the new revenue standard, an entity is the principal to the transaction if the nature of its promise is to provide specified goods or services to a customer. An entity would be the agent to a transaction if the nature of its promise is to arrange for another party to provide those specified goods and services. An entity is a principal if it controls a promised good or service before the entity transfers the good or service to the customer. The standard also includes a list of indicators that an entity is an agent to the transaction. When an entity that is a principal satisfies its performance obligation, they recognize revenue in the gross amount of consideration which it expects to be entitled in exchange of those goods or services, that is, gross revenue. When an entity that is an agent satisfies a performance obligation, they recognize revenue in the amount of the fee or commission which they expect to be entitled for arranging the other party to provide the goods or services, that is, net revenue. Implementation questions have primarily related to how to interpret the guidance for services or intangible items because it may be more difficult in those circumstances to determine who has control in those types of transactions. For example, recently there's been an emergence of new types of intangible or virtual goods and service arrangements through the use of the internet, including social networking and mobile app stores. For these new type of arrangements, for example, online gaming, there may be diversity in how entities determine if they are the principal of the transaction or the agent, and therefore whether they recognize revenue gross or net. Stakeholders have reported to us that the determination becomes difficult in circumstances where the good or service received by the customer is a non-physical item, the cash received by the originator is a net amount of an amount is net of an amount retained by the intermediary. Oftentimes, it's the party on the front end of the transaction that has the difficulty in making the principal agent determination. And it may not always be apparent who the customer is in the transaction. For example, whether the originator's customer is the intermediary or if their customer is the end customer. Stakeholders have reported three potential implementations in this area. The first issue is how should the agency indicators in the new standard be applied to contracts involving certain intangible goods or services? The second issue is if the entity determines it is the principal, which typically results in gross revenue, what amount of revenue should they recognize if they received a net amount of cash and do not know the gross amount? And the third issue is how should the transaction price allocation guidance be applied to a transaction in which the entity is principal for some of the deliverables and agent for others? The FASB and the IASB would like TRG members' input on your views about the potential implementation issues, whether you're aware of other interpretations for any of the issues, and whether there are any related potential interpretation issues that the group should consider.
So that, I think, the idea, Mary, you want the group to start with the first issue, the interaction of the indicators, principal versus agent, particularly with respect to the emerging types of transactions that are teed up in the paper. Anyone? Perspectives? Is this an issue that we? Yes, Alan.
Yeah. Could you, I guess, inform us what current practice is under current guidance and how maybe current guidance indicators might differ from where the revised guidance would potentially take us?
Sure. So the current guidance includes a list of indicators that you look at to determine whether you're the principal or agent of the transaction. In the new standard, the guidance has changed in that there's an overriding principle of first determining who controls the transaction, and then if you're not sure who has control, you look to the agency indicators to determine if you're principal or agent. So it's some of the indicators are similar to what was there in the past, but the difference is the overlaying concept of control and the interaction of how the indicators work with that.
And so if you don't know who controls, do you go to those indicators then to determine who controls? Is that?
Well, that's one of the questions we have is, there's two different views. One is that you determine who controls. If you're not sure, then you go to the indicators. Another view is that the indicators and the control principle work together and that they're both helping you determine, that the indicators are helping you determine who controls.
Okay. And do you know what current practice is right now? What people, what companies are doing?
In terms of, currently there's no control principle, it's just the indicators. There's certain weighting of indicators today in practice. So that's another question that we have in terms of does the new standard weight the indicators equally or are some more important than others?
I think with respect to some of the developing types of transactions, we were aware that even prior to the finalization of the new standard, there were some questions in practice as to applying the existing factors. So there may have been some degree of either diversity or one could say maybe reasonable judgment in applying those factors that might result in different outcomes under existing.
Scott?
I'm going to touch on a couple of the same things. I think Mary sort of gave away perhaps her bias there when she first described if you have control, then it's gross. If you don't, go to the indicators. So that would be that's certainly one way to handle it. To paraphrase the way that would be interpreted under current U.S. GAAP, that would suggest that what we now think of as the general inventory risk indicator is determinative under the new standard. I don't know if it was meant to be. I can read it both ways. One, to say if you figure out control, you're done. If you don't, go to the indicators. And the other to say actually you use the indicators to figure out whether you have control or not. And to me, that's – if I look at the words of the new standard, I think that's the real question. Do you look at these indicators to decide whether you have control, or do you look at these indicators if you can't otherwise figure out whether you have control? Realistically, I'm not sure you're going to get a different answer too often, depending upon which way you do this. I would say I get questions on gross versus net all of the time. It is largely the intangible virtual goods that are generating the issues now, as well as some services. But the questions come on things that happen very quickly. I mean, we're talking in many cases internet goods or services transaction where every party does whatever it is they do within a half a second. You know, it all happens at the same time. And I think that makes it very hard under the current guidance, and it ain't going to get any easier on the new guidance. So I wouldn't say that these questions are coming up because of the new standard, though. They exist today, and they're very difficult to deal with today. One other thing that I note from reading the paper and also from Mary's introduction, when I think about the originator of these transactions, you know, the party that has the good or service to begin with, and we're trying to figure out whether that party's customer is the intermediary or is the end customer, I usually think about that a little bit different. I say that party is definitely a principal, is definitely going to recognize revenue gross. It's just a matter of whether their customer is the intermediary or the end. I find that to be a different question, not necessarily an easier one, because I got to figure out how much the gross revenue is. But that's a different question than when the intermediary is making the call, because the originator is definitely going to recognize revenue for the sale of the good or service, The question is whether the intermediary's customer is the end customer, or excuse me, the originator's customer is the end customer and the intermediary is working for the originator, or whether the originator's customer is the intermediary and the intermediary is working for the end customer. So I think it's a little bit different question, and what you may be grossing up for the originator is the cost of buying the intermediary's service or not. So it's a slightly different question. And I think if it does get to the point of guidance or more discussion, we might need to discuss those issues separately.
Scott, from your experience, is the difficulty, in terms of the indicators, is the difficulty mainly that some of these newer types of transactions don't fit well with the indicators, or that the indicators provide, you know, conflicting answers on gross net, or both?
I think it is both. I mean, for example, when we talk about control of the good or service, that's a key principle today in a current gap with general inventory and primary obligor, and it's key in the new standard as well. When you're talking about internet advertising, right, where, you know, the ad is going to run on a website, so they're the originator. It goes through Google Ads. It perhaps goes through an agency. And then finally, you have the purchaser of the advertiser at the end of this. Well, it all happens literally in milliseconds. Why do I ever care who controls that thing? I mean, it starts with the website. Within 10 milliseconds, somebody has bought the right to put their ad on that website, and I'm going to try to figure out whether any of the three or four parties in the middle ever controlled it. That's really, really hard. So I just think, you know, in that case, I understand the focus on control. I mean, from a conceptual level, makes a heck of a lot of sense, but it's almost irrelevant in that kind of transaction whether the people in the middle could ever be thought to control anything, because it's passing through all of those parties like that. So I think in those kinds of transactions, focusing on control is never going to give you a satisfactory answer. So then we need to move to the other indicators. There I think then you wind up with issues of, if you've ever looked at any of these contracts, for the intermediary parties, it's pretty hard to figure out who they think their customers are. And I think in large part, they think that the parties all through the chain are benefiting from their services. And sometimes they have contracts with parties all through the chain that aren't clear as to who's buying what from whom. So it is hard to figure out the nature of the promise. And that's just a business issue, not an issue of the standard.
Mark. This is Mark Crowley with Deloitte. I agree with Scott. I think the question that we tend to jump to is sort of who is the customer that we're dealing with. And if I sell something through an intermediary and I have a contract with that intermediary that I'm going to get paid X amount every time they sell virtual coins or a gift card or whatever it is, a lot of folks will jump and say, well, my contract is with that intermediary, and that's my customer. So I'm trying to figure out, am I going to recognize the fixed amount I'm getting as gross or net? And generally, you get the gross. I guess when you look at it through the eyes of, you know, what is the good or service, the service that you're providing, if I'm hosting a website that's going to use the coins, or I'm providing a service that a gift card is going to be used on, well, I'm always going to be the one providing that hosting. Am I providing it to the intermediary for whoever they designate it to, if they sell it to someone, or in fact, sometimes they can just give them away as marketing type things, you know, come to my website and I'll give you free coins. Well, I'm certainly not going to record zero revenue in that transaction. That doesn't seem to make sense just because they gave it away. So I understand the concept of looking at, you know, the good or service and who controls it, but like Scott was saying, it's a lot of times it's instantaneous. Well, I'm not going to, the intermediary is not going to buy the coins until they know they have someone that they're going to sell them to, and then they just sort of go through immediately. So then when you look at these indicators, and Colin, I think it's a little bit what your question, I think you get conflicting answers when you look at these. And I can read, you know, A to B, I'm the primary responsible. I can, you know, inventory risk is sort of a moot point. There's no inventory here. It's a virtual type good. I mean, and then, you know, establishing prices and the economics really are what I would focus on, and who has the discretion. If the customer can take them and give them away for free, discount them to 50%, or and no matter what, they're going to pay you a fixed amount. It seems like the economics should play into it too. So I think the indicators, when you look at these, you could clearly get to two different answers for very similar transactions. So I think it's something that if you want it to, a service is almost always going to be your fulfilling it. So when you look at it at a service, if you say who controls that service before it goes to the ultimate customer, whoever it is, it seems like that would always put you in a gross position if you're the entity providing through the intermediary. But if that's what the goal is of this standard, then maybe it should just be pointed out. But when you get to these indicators, you could clearly meet one, two, or three of them and, you know, point yourself towards gross or net in either case. And I think you get conflicting answers a lot of times. And then obviously subject to second guessing by anyone that comes in and checks you afterwards.
Yeah, and Mark, you said something interesting there that, you know, obviously the inventory indicator wouldn't apply, and that's one of the questions you know, we had in the paper, and that there's two views that it may or may not apply in that circumstance. Do you think about the inventory indicator as just tangible inventory, or in the gaming circumstance, do you think about, well, they've got to maintain the hosting and they've got capitalized software and all these other assets that are at risk? You know, should people take a broader view of inventory, or should it just be applied to tangible inventory?
Right. I think if you're looking at these transactions, I'm the entity providing it to the intermediary, and the intermediary is selling it. I'm always, in my mind, going to be, I'm the one providing the service. I'm the hosting or whatever it's going to be. That question becomes more, who's my customer? If I sell a gift card through a retailer to come to my pizza shop to buy pizza, well, I'm, you know, obviously I'm the primary obligor. I'm the one, I'm going to record something gross. The question is, am I going to record gross what I get from the retailer, which is a fixed price, or do I have to somehow figure out what the retailer is selling it for? They could call it a loss leader. Come in and spend $100 and you get a free gift card. Well, you know, or I can, or they could say they could sell it for face value, or they could sell it for something less than face value. In my mind, you look at it, you can say, well, the customer is the retailer, and I'm just going to provide the service to whoever they designate is going to get it, and whoever they sell it to, and it sort of transfers. But I understand the other side, where a lot of folks will say, no, you're the primary obligor in that arrangement. You should record it gross, and there can only be one agent and one principal, and that if the other party is the agent, then somehow you have to have a commission expense.
If I could just jump in real quick, something you said almost seemed to dovetail off of what Scott said, and I might be interested to hear you either follow up on it or somebody else in the group. You almost seemed to indicate that one of the things that might indicate who the customer is who controls the economics of the transaction, meaning that you brought up a couple times the notion of a loss leader, that the intermediary may decide that even though I'm going to pay you $3, I'm willing to sell it on to an end customer at zero or a dollar, and in that type of scenario, control of the economics of the transaction might be something to think about in terms of control, or in terms of the notion of does that help you determine who the customer is of the original party? And I just wanted to see, was I somewhat hearing a point you were hitting on correctly, and see if anybody else picked up on that.
Yeah, you heard the point right. I mean, that's we've thought about that. Now, if you look at these indicators, you can say, well, they're not weighted, so yeah, maybe I'm fulfilling it, or you know, I look at the pricing, and I could say, maybe there are two principals in some of these transactions where I'm the principal to the intermediary, and the intermediary is selling it to whoever they want or giving it away, and they're the principal in that transaction. Not very unsimilar to if I'm a manufacturer and I sell something to a retail store, and then the retail store sells it on to the end customer. There's two principals in that transaction. They're both recording it gross, and I don't think that's that could be happening if the economics in the arrangement are such that they have the ability, the pricing in that case would be something that I would look to more strongly than I would say whether the good or service is control transfers.
Allison.
Jim, could I ask a question of Mark, please?
Sure, and then please. Go ahead.
I just have a question on his use of the word gross. He keeps saying that it's going to be recognized gross. But we've got, you know, we've got the originator and we've got the intermediary and we've got the final customer. Does he mean gross to the final customer, or how's he using that word? I didn't quite understand.
That's the question. You got if, and that's what Scott was talking about. If the customer is my intermediate, the gross amount is what I'm getting from the intermediary. If somehow I have to say gross is the end customer that happens to be coming into my store or coming in and hosting, then somehow you'd have to figure out what the intermediary sold it for. If it's very clear, maybe it is gross to the end customer. If it's a very clear agency relationship where you're getting a fixed amount, or the intermediary is getting a fixed amount or a fixed type of commission, but to the extent they have all the pricing and economic risk of what they're selling it for, they could sell it for whatever they want. I think you might look at the intermediary as your customer. So it depends on who your customer is.
Did that answer your question, Ian?
No.
I think that
was fine. Thanks, Jim.
Okay.
Not great, just fine.
Thanks. So just reacting a little bit to some of the dialogue and a couple of other points. On your point about who controls the economics, when I think about that, I think about pricing risk. And I know that in some fact patterns that we have addressed, the pricing risk sometimes does become determinative. When we think of apps, and you have companies that develop apps, you have companies that host the apps on their platform, sometimes determining which entity controls the pricing risk has, in some instances, been determinative for purposes of the accounting conclusion for whether you have gross versus net. If the intermediary is controlling the pricing of the app and what that price is set at, then the intermediary might be recording the revenue gross versus if it's the developer that's setting the pricing risk or setting the price, that might indicate that the developer should be recording revenue on a gross basis. You know, it's interesting when talking about pricing risk, I noticed one of the fact patterns that's written up here, kind of described in paragraph 21, the one about the virtual goods example. It was a little bit interesting as we were debating this issue. It's different than fact patterns that we're familiar with. It's kind of describes that the intermediary is the one that's setting the price. And in our experience, that typically isn't the case. The developer of the game is typically setting the price of whatever it is that they're providing in terms of the good or service. But then the intermediary may be running promotional type specials or something that would allow somebody to access something within a game at a price different than what the developer has actually set the price at. And I think in those instances, there typically has not been a debate about pricing risk in terms of the intermediary. The intermediary is really just running a promotion. And so ultimately, that the price that the developer sets for the game or whatever it is ultimately ends up being the revenue that's recognized. And the viewpoint there is that primary obligor ends up being the determining factor. That inventory risk, I think a lot of companies for intangible goods and services don't think about inventory risk, although some recent dialogue related to internet advertising has caused some entities to pause a little bit and think about that a little bit more. But to this point, it's really primary obligor in those situations in determining who should be recording the revenue for this. And you know, I don't know if we're going to get a little bit further on in the discussion about in issue two which view you would take, views A through D, but I think you know, oftentimes today, even if an end customer might be paying a price that's different than what the developer sets as the price because the intermediary is running a special or some sort of a promotion, the question of, well, should the developer then, because they don't know the price that the end consumer is ultimately paying, should they have to be forced to estimate that? In our experience in practice today is that entities are not doing those estimates. So I think that would probably push you closer towards, if you're looking at views A, B, C, and D, closer to a view D. That's issue two.
Larry Smith.
Yes, Scott, you indicated that you get these questions frequently, and I'm assuming you're getting those questions under current GAAP. I guess my question is twofold. A, do you find that you're able to answer the question to your satisfaction under current GAAP? And B, do you think the guidance in the new revenue recognition standard is significantly different from current GAAP to cause you to believe that the new standard would not allow you to answer the question, assuming you feel comfortable with your answers under current GAAP?
No and no.
Thanks for your help.
That's why I'm here.
Tom. I'd like a little better insight into why there is confusion once you think about who the customer is and the contract with the customer. Is it because they're implied contracts? It just seems that if the originator is going to be sending something to the intermediary, there would be an explicit contract or an implied contract between the two that would not just specify what needs to be transferred, but what the price would be between for that transfer. And it would seem the confusion would should arise or only arise if there were contracts between the originator and the intermediary and the originator and the end customer that would have pricing terms that would potentially be gross in both places. Because if what I'm doing is eventually having the end customer be my customer in an explicit or implied contract, it would seem that the contract with the intermediary would be a net commission-based contract rather than as a delivery device rather than gross. So I would like better insight into the confusion if we start first concentrating on the contract rather than control and or the indicators.
Tom, I guess that was probably directed at me. Or both of us. I guess if you just think about a simple transaction where, like, take a gift card and you go into a Costco here and you can buy a gift card to get $100 at Morton's, I guess. You can buy that for $80. And Morton sells it to Costco for $70. They don't activate the card until it actually sells. The question becomes, Morton's is getting $70, or whoever the restaurant is getting $70 from Costco. Costco's transferring that right to go into that restaurant to one of their customers. They could sell it at $80, they could sell it at $90, they could sell it at $100, they could give it away for free, they could sell it, they could combine it with other discounts, they could do whatever they want with it. But no matter what, I'm going to get $70 as the restaurant. So if you say that the transaction is between the ultimate customer that's coming in, because I'm going to provide the service to Costco's customer. If you say that that's that they're an agent and I'm the principal, there's some that would argue that you have to record whatever Costco gets for that gift card, not the $70. You're the restaurant. Because if you're gross and you say Costco's the agent, then they're getting an agency fee, and you're the gross. They're just acting as your agent. But I would say that your customer is Costco, and that you're providing a service to Costco for whoever they designate to come in.
Why?
I'm not in the.
What is the other side to that argument? That right. Seems right to me. What is the other?
The
side
primary.
The other side to that argument is that the restaurant is the one that's actually providing the meal or whatever it is to the end customer, and that is the good or service that the end customer ultimately wants. And so that's the price, that's the revenue that the restaurant should be earning. Yes, so the primary obligor.
But how would the restaurant
know what Costco sold it for?
You may or may not.
They don't. That's
yeah,
issue
oftentimes
two.
Oftentimes you don't.
So if you
that's
don't know two. What they sold it for, how could you recognize revenue
go find
that amount?
Mark's done.
But isn't that an indicator that maybe that's not the right number?
In that question, yes. I would have answered very quickly the same way. Yes. The restaurant's customer is Costco. I have less trouble figuring out these answers from the standpoint of the originator than I do from the standpoint of the intermediary in many transactions. So Costco is probably the principal in the transaction with me, but some might say maybe not. Costco doesn't pay for the gift card until they sell it on, and Costco never has to deliver any food. So maybe Costco ought to be net and only recognize their margin as revenue. Harder, however, to get back to Tom's question, And I'm going to go back to internet advertising only because I've had like 9 questions on this in the last 6 months. I've run into situations where the intermediary that I would describe as a matchmaker, except that that sort of is pejorative as to what you think the answer might be, but the intermediary has a contract with an ad agency. The ad agency then has a contract with actual advertisers, but the intermediary has a contract with the ad agency and a contract with the website that has space to sell. The website has no contract with an ad agency and has no contract with an advertiser. Yet, it is absolutely clear from the contracts that what intermediary does is match them. So now you look at it and you say, well, the website is selling advertising space to someone. The only party they have a contract with is the intermediary, but that contract doesn't even say they're selling ad space. And for the intermediary, they have no contract that says they're ever buying ad space, so how could they be selling it? So yet you're in a situation where if you look at those three parties, the only party that the website, the originator, has a contract with is the intermediary, so seems like that's the only party that could be their customer, except that that contract doesn't involve selling ad space at all. Then you can get to your implied contract, Tom. But, boy, it's really hard to make a decision as to who is the obligor and what the promise is based on an implied contract. I can tell you that that doesn't go over well with regulators a lot of times.
Ian, I see you're tense up, and let's turn the discussion over to the folks in London.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim. Christoph had a question.
I've got to admit I struggle with the idea of an implied contract, in particular combined with the idea that I don't know what the end customer is paying. Because I would assume that even an implied contract would need to meet the definition of a contract under the standard. One of the criteria of the definition is that the entity can identify the payment terms for the goods or services to be transferred. If I don't even know how much the customer is paying, I certainly don't know the payment terms. So how could I get to an implied contract?
Okay. Any other comments at the... at the London Inn. Brian.
So a few general observations, perhaps a frame comment. It seems to me that the question both for the originator and the intermediary is really about what's the nature of the promise, and that's where I would always start. And I think different originators and different intermediaries make different promises. And I would need to understand the promise in as much detail as possible. And because people make different types of promises, perhaps I'll get to different answers in different cases. And the fact that I'm getting to different answers in different cases doesn't trouble me. The issue is obviously where's the dividing line, what's the grey area. There have been a few comments about the position of the originator. I would think that the originator was always a principal, and the question is, what is the originator's promise? And that's the answer to the, well, that's the way I would approach the originator question. For the intermediary, I'm looking at the nature of the promise. I'm trying to tell, in the first instance, whether it's clear that they have control more than momentarily, and perhaps in some of these particular types of fact patterns, this is going to be when control is only momentarily. There were references to milliseconds, so perhaps the answer is not going to be obvious. I then look at the indicators to inform my assessment again, but it's an overall assessment, and I don't think the indicators can take me to a place that would absolutely contradict what I would have gotten to if all I had was control. I consider them together to try and make an overall assessment. There were comments about there's no weighting of the indicators, and I can't see a weighting of the indicators. I'm used to having an indicator approach under current IFRS, and I can see I have an indicator approach under this new standard. But what I found in practice applying these indicators is that some are more important in some circumstances than others. I can't see an implicit inherent hierarchy of the indicators that exists independently of the facts and circumstances. There were references to surely the economics of the arrangement need to come in, and perhaps one of the ways they come in is they help you decide which are the more important indicators in a given fact pattern. So I think what I was hearing in the early part of the discussion was that there was something inherently kind of worrying or disturbing about the fact that it was sometimes difficult to assess control, or that indicators might point in different ways. I'm not sure that I see such a big inherent problem, because I can see how I will wrap everything up together with the goal of reaching an overall assessment.
Okay, thank you. Tony.
Yeah, I think, like others have said, and there's always going to be an element of judgment around this decision, and I don't think that's going to change at all under the new standard. I think it's inherently difficult in some of these transactions when, as Scott said, they all happen instantaneously, to determine who might be the customer, whether or not there's control, and so on. And like others have said, I think used to working with a framework of indicators under the existing standard. Where I think there's perhaps an element of extra tension that's being created by the new standard is the overlay of the notion of control, because I think it does seem from the way the guidance has been crafted that the overarching principle is whether or not there is control. And I think, like others have said, we would perhaps typically have started from thinking about who is the customer in the arrangement. And that does seem to me to be important, because if the intermediary's customer is the originator, that makes it sound a bit like the intermediary is going to be agent. If the intermediary's customer is the end user, then perhaps you need to think about whether or not the intermediary does in fact obtain control. And I think when you look at the indicators, I think they can actually give you a conflicting solution, because I think if you focus on the one hand on primary obligor and on the other hand on who controls the economics, and I guess my sense of where the new guidance might be challenging is that I'm not sure that all of those strands are completely pulled together. So, for example, do you start off by just thinking about control, or do you start off by thinking about the indicators? Do you start off by thinking about the customer, or who is the customer, or do you start off thinking about the indicators? Is it important to think about primary obligor in all of the circumstances, or do you think about whether or not one party or another drives the economics? And I think one of the interesting notions that a couple of the examples specifically introduce is the idea that the intermediary might control a right before it is delivered to the end customer. So I think the example about airline tickets talks about controlling the right, and you say that the intermediary actually bought an inventory. I guess I wonder how you might think about that in the context of balancing the control of the economics with primary obligor if the inventory is not purchased beforehand. And so I guess my overall sense is comfortable with making the judgments, but I just wonder if there's a couple of strands of this that might be pulled together a bit more clearly given the overlay of control in the new model.
How would you do that?
I think it's the the question perhaps for the boards is whether or not you intended to us to look at control as the first step and say, is there something that is controlled by the intermediary? Like others have said, I think the originator is always going to be principal for something, but is there something that is controlled by the intermediary? Or is do we start by looking at the indicators?
Do you find that the basis doesn't perhaps pull those strands together? Because I think what Brian was describing seems to sort of very much flowing the logic of the basis for conclusions, which I was just looking at. But I was wondering whether there was something missing in the basis when you said pulling the strands together. The other thing, Glenn, you touch on, I mean, there's always this challenge, isn't there, with the primary obligor when you're talking about rights. Because if you're essentially buying rights and reselling rights, and of course, you're not going to be the guy actually providing the underlying service that the customer's fundamentally acquiring. So I think that has to be sort of considered when you're thinking about, you know, the nature of the type of things we're talking about here.
I think there were two questions, Henry. I think as far as the first is concerned, I think the logic that seems to flow through the basis of conclusions is that the first question is whether or not a party obtains control, and that the second question, or if that is not clear, then you look to the indicators to determine whether or not the party has control and is therefore principal in the arrangement. And I think the basis says specifically the indicators are there for a different purpose. But then I think, well, the indicators are pretty much the same as they were before. And I'm not sure when I look at what's in the application guidance, the flow comes through quite as clearly as it comes through in the basis for conclusions. And that's why I wondered whether it could be clarified. And I do think that to pick up on your second question about the transfer of a right rather than delivery of the underlying goods and services, and I do think that's an important notion. It's something that perhaps wasn't particularly clear in the IFRS space before. And I think that there's a couple of interesting questions around that, around whether or not an intermediary can control a right that didn't exist before the transaction. So it's actually granting that right as part of the transaction. Does the intermediary control that before the transaction? So if I issue a loyalty point, do I control that right before I issue it if I've negotiated the economics with the party that will fulfill it and the customer? Or if I had, I haven't taken the risk by buying any sort of inventory in it, does that mean that I don't control it beforehand?
Other comments? No, we don't have any more here, I don't think, Jim. So back to you.
Okay, there's a couple here maybe on this, and then we can move on to issue two. Ian, maybe we can start with issue two in London. But I had Alan over here.
I think by first adding this control notion first is actually adding complexity into the issue, meaning the criteria in current GAAP as well as in the new GAAP on how to look at whether something is a principal versus an agent is exactly the same. And I guess it's a question, did the board think that they were changing current GAAP by putting in the indicators as well as this control notion? I didn't think so. And if the board did not think that they were changing current GAAP, then really the indicators are what people should be looking to first, as opposed to going to a first stop of control and then looking at the indicators. Because if you're going to go to a first stop of control, you very well could get a different answer.
Allison?
Just reflecting on some comments I think Tony was focusing on a few minutes ago about needing to look at the control of the good or service The question that comes up for me is the control of what? Is it the control of the underlying good or service that the customer ultimately receives, or is it control of the right to access the underlying good or service? And I think the airline example and the standard tries to make that distinction, but when you take that particular fact pattern and move it into more of an intangible or a virtual environment, it gets really tough. So let's go to Mark, back to Mark's fact pattern, where we've got a restaurant that's selling or selling its services, selling it through Costco, and we were arguing or debating a little bit as to, well, you know, if the $100 restaurant meal or whatever it is being sold to Costco and Costco is then selling it on to its end customer at 100 or 95, you know, should Costco be recognizing that at 100? Should we be recognizing that at 90 or 95? I think that that's a question that sometimes you might think to yourself, well, does Costco have the right to that in the form of gift cards or some sort of item that you could argue is a form of inventory right, inventory risk? But when you move that again into an intangible or a virtual type world, let's take a situation where a customer wants to get that $100 right to go to a restaurant, and let's say they're going to buy it through a discount website where they actually would pay $25 for a right to go into a restaurant and get a discounted meal. The sometimes in those arrangements, in my example, $100 meal, $25 voucher that you're purchasing, that $25 voucher, there may be a 50-50 split between the amount that the entity, the discount website, will ultimately retain versus the amount that's going to end up going back to the restaurant in that fact pattern. The question that comes up, should revenue be 25 or should revenue be 1250? Is it 1250 because that's the agency fee? Because ultimately what the customer wants, the underlying, this gets to my question of what is the control of the underlying good or service. Is it that the end consumer wants the meal at the restaurant? The discount website can't provide that. It's only the restaurant that can provide that. So the agency fee, the 1250, is the only amount of revenue that should be recognized by the discount website. Or is it that the discount website sold something for $25 and that they have an amount that they're paying back to the retailer in the form of $12.50, so revenue's $25 and cost of goods sold is $12.50 because they sold, they're in the business of selling discount vouchers. So I think that's the debate, and I know that in fact patterns that we've dealt with, the underlying determinant factor is what is the end consumer looking to purchase. They're not purchasing a discount voucher. They're purchasing the right to go to a restaurant for a meal. It's the control of that underlying good or service, and those fact patterns has been determinative.
Russell?
Maybe this is more of a process question. You know, when I read this guidance, and I think Larry was touching on this, it seems as though it's consistent with existing. I think the intent was for it to be consistent. The control notion, I think it's interesting, but it seems consistent with the way people have placed more weight on primary obligor and general inventory risk. So it seemed, at least to me, to be consistent. So one of my concerns about this forum and this group is, are we going to try and answer questions that we haven't been able to answer under existing GAAP and spin our wheels? You know, I'm surprised issue two is not what is a deliverable, right? So I worry that, you know, if we don't focus on the things that are sort of new and the interaction of new words as opposed to concepts that are sort of the existing today that we struggle with, that we haven't been able to answer in the past, I just worry that we're not going to be as effective as we might be, so otherwise be.
I think that's a fair point, particularly with respect to this issue. But I think in part, at least from my perspective, this was an issue where the board is getting educated, whether it's the new standard or exist, you know, even if we didn't have the new standard, is there a need for the boards to take some action? So I appreciate that you could say it's in many respects not an issue, and I think Scott said that as well when he answered no and no. Yeah, okay. I had Mark, Scott, and then Russ can get in at any point. You can preempt the discussion if you want. Okay.
I guess I was wondering, I've heard a lot of conversation about step two and what's the promise and control, but I was wondering what people thought about step one and the step one analysis of of identifying the contract, and whether or not that's illustrative or helpful at all in identifying the customer. In Mark Crowley's example of the steakhouse, you know, providing services through Costco, the contract is between Morton's and Costco. Is it possible, does anybody think it's possible that Morton's has a contract with a customer that it doesn't, I mean, I guess that's getting at Tom's implied contract. Do people think that, you know, if you go through a step one analysis, does that help you at all in trying to figure out who the contract is with, at least, and who the customer might be, to then figure out the promise to that particular customer? I was just wondering if people had any thoughts about that, because that is a little bit different from current GAAP, because I agree with Russell Hodge's point. You know, while the words might be similar in this particular implementation guidance with today's GAAP, the paradigm may or may not be a little different, so I'm just wondering what people think about that.
You better, I think you have to exercise caution there, because are you implying that perhaps the contract is between Morton's and this ultimate customer? Because if it is,
no, I was implying
it actually will be when somebody's got the gift card.
Yeah,
I mean, that guy shows up to Morton's and Morton says, "No, I don't have a contract
but
with you."
Is that two separate contracts? And so I'm just wondering how people are thinking about the step one analysis. I've heard a lot about step two, and I'm just wondering if step one is helpful at all.
I've tried to make it helpful under current GAAP. I mean, current GAAP doesn't have that guidance, but I think you still got to figure out who your customer is and what your contract is. So I think it's already there. I mean, the fact that it's explicit in the new standard and isn't in current GAAP, I don't think changes practice. We already start out by figuring out what's the contract, who's the customer, and what have we promised to do. And we'll do that under the new guidance. And I think it will be similarly difficult. I did want to respond briefly. Henry mentioned the basis for conclusions, and asked whether it helps. It didn't help me because it has all the same points of discussion as the standard and still is unclear as to whether there's an order, right? It starts out BC 381, identifying an entity's promise in a contract is fundamental to the determination of whether the entity is acting as principal or agent. If I stopped there, I could say all I got to do is read the contract. Then goes on to say, however, to conclude whether they're a principal or agent, you also have to consider whether it controls the right before transferring it to the customer. And then the very next sentence, the nature of the entity's promise may not always be readily apparent. So I think the basis does what the standard does as well in terms of pointing out things that are all important. I don't mean to suggest that it's needlessly confusing anything, but it's pointing out a number of things that are all important without telling you, but here's the only one to look at.
So I'm going to try to articulate what I think I'm hearing the concern, and I don't think it's because of the new standard. I think it's both the old and the new. It is that there is a confusion or uncertainty about how to deal with transactions whereby the intermediary has no inventory risk. Because the transaction does not result, it's not a cost. Meaning the gift card has virtually no cost to it. So the supplier doesn't need to get an upfront payment, unlike detergent. Even though in this case the intermediary has probably the same agreement that they would have with Procter & Gamble. If the detergent doesn't push through the system, they'll push it back. There's no debate there. People don't argue who the customer is. I'm the customer when I go to the intermediary and I buy the detergent. And the intermediary is the customer to Procter & Gamble when they buy the detergent. But the intermediary has the ability to push that back. They have the ability to get price concessions if they don't do the detergent. So it seems to me the issue is, that's the first issue. The second issue is when you basically have, for lack of better words, intermediaries that are making a market. And we have the ability to determine how market makers account for things when they make markets in financial instruments, but we're not sure how to deal with it when you make markets in other activities because you don't know who the other side is. Those are what I hear the two issues are. and you, there's just uncertainty how to deal with it because those scenarios did not exist when the original thing that Jim, I don't know if you created, but it was done around the, in the late 90s. Is that really what I'm, am I hearing that right? Okay. Is that what I'm hearing as the issues?
One of the things that I was wondering about is, in the example that Mark had given, is whether my end customer is the store or my end customer is the person who bought the gift card and came in for the meal. Do I ever have an expectation of getting paid more than the $70? And if I don't have that expectation, does that determine that my transaction price can't be more than $70, irregardless of who my customer is?
Yeah, but I don't hear the issue being the restaurant. I hear the issue being the intermediary in that scenario. And so because the intermediary can change whatever they want, they don't really have any risk because they only pay the $70 if Scott comes in to buy the card. And so it's the confusion of you have no risk in that. I would argue that these major intermediaries have very little risk in all the other products that they sell because they can push it back. And that doesn't seem to be a problem to anybody. So I don't understand, honestly, why the gift card's a problem for the intermediary.
So I think, though, your question, Michael, is a perfect segue to issue two, which gets to, I think, the question of in that fact pattern, is your revenue the 70, or, and maybe people don't think that in the gift card scenario, but I think it certainly comes up in other scenarios, is do you need to look through to the ultimate end user if you're the originator and somehow impute the revenue that's there, particularly in fact patterns where you have no idea what the intermediary is selling for, or I think even in Mark's example, the intermediary may pay for it and choose to give it away. Do you then have no revenue, in fact, when you received revenue? And Ian, if you'd like, you want to start the discussion on the second issue in London?